But the reality is that as people, you're not always going to be at your tip-top shape, your most enthusiastic self, the most optimistic self all the time.
Welcome to the Grinders Table, the podcast where we sit with C-suite executives and founders who are taking their industry by storm to figure out how you can build an exceptional career and business. Together, we'll try to uncover how they have both defined the odds and what you can learn from their experience.
Hi, everyone. Today, we have the first of its kind. It's a tag team of really, really great people that I've been itching to speak to. Again, in my usual fashion, you know I don't like introducing people. So I would let Mark and Cindy or the ever-present Dream VC team introduce themselves.
Awesome. Mark, maybe I could go first and then tag team style, you could jump in afterwards. Hello, everyone. I'm Cindy. I'm one of the co-founders of Dream VC. Quick background on me. So I guess the boring version is that on my end, I started off as an entrepreneur, but I didn't build a tech company. I built a marketing firm. I then went on to become a growth operator at various fast-scaling startups, specifically in Southeast Asia, in the verticals of e-commerce as well as logistics, and eventually pivoted into VC. I was very privileged in the sense that I had a very serendipitous start in VC. One of my very first mentors ran 8 different global VC firms across the world. So I had a very comprehensive vertical and horizontal view into the venture ecosystem. One of the funds that he ran is Savannah Fund that's in Africa. And that was what really made me fall in love with the continent. And some other facts about me that's non-professional is I really love food. So if you are a foodie, then we will become fast friends. And I used to go to a manor school when I was younger. So the stuffy cotillions that you hear about where the girls had the white dresses and the sort of lacy gloves, I was one of those girls. And clearly I have fallen very far away from that tree now.
It's amazing how so many things we used to do when we were younger, we don't even do that again. And people can't necessarily reconcile those two people, like two separate people. And again, that's growth and life. Mark, over to you.
Well, it's always difficult to follow a great introduction like that, but I guess I'm trying my best. So hello, everyone. My name is Mark. I'm the other co-founder of Dream VC. My background is perhaps somewhat similar, albeit without the entrepreneurial context. So on my end, I started in consulting. I spent some time as a growth operator and had the privilege, or I guess the benefit, of working across a couple of different ecosystems in mostly consumer-focused startup and scale-up, in both in Asia, the Americas, and Europe. Now, on my end, I also broke into VC somewhat unconventionally, largely because I actually originally really, really wanted to transition into the space when I first came across it while working in the consulting industry, and essentially broke into a role by creating one for myself in a very lean fund. That would come to be really kind of career defining, because in a lean fund, you end up taking on many and many responsibilities, as I'm sure you've seen over time. And that led me to then jump fund to fund, fellowship to fellowship, program to program, until finally settling on a set of sectors that I found interesting and eventually making my way to focus on emerging markets again. For me, I was actually born in Moscow in Russia, so I always had a desire to go back to working with an emerging market focus, where I think there's a lot more change, a lot more improvement that is possible to achieve. So I was very happy when the opportunity came up to do so in an African context. And yeah, the last few years have really been really crazy. But I guess one cool fact I will say about me is before I knew anything at all about African markets, many years before I'd ever been to an African country, and before I even moved away from Russia, the one connection that I maybe did have was my favorite animal ever since I was about 4 years old was a hippopotamus. And there was, I think, one in Russia at the time. And I thought it was really fascinating. And I kind of kept that as a personal hobby to the point where even now, years later, I have a collection of various hippo statues and hippo stuff that I've picked up over the years from all my travels. And it just grows bigger and bigger.
How much of vodka do you like drinking?
How large is it now?
I mean, yeah. there are these thoughts that you can't outdrink a Russian.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's a bit of a crazy story, but nonetheless, like now, though, it's something that I look back on and it's been somewhat formative for me.
Okay. You both have really interesting stories, and I'm going to dig deep into the stories soon. But everything you did sort of led you to venture capital. In hindsight, what are some of the expectations that you had of venture or venture capital generally that you see isn't it? You know, some of the assumptions you thought, and they've totally changed now that you've been in venture for a while.
Oh, really good one. I think I have two big ones that will probably be shocking for people that aren't in VC, but everyone that's in VC definitely acknowledge. I think the first thing is that before I went to VC, I thought this was a very glamorous career. So my parents still don't really understand what VC is. So to this day, my parents' impression of VC was like what I used to think, which is a bunch of guys in a suit with, you know, suitcases of cash, and they're investing in these like early stage companies, and they're these like big, awesome people. But then the day-to-day, especially if you're a VC in Africa, is not glamorous at all. And you have a lot of pressure in your work. I think the second thing is that people know what they're doing. I don't know if this is controversial in the sense that I think from the outside, the way that a lot of investors like to present themselves, whether that's on Twitter or in conversations, is that they know everything that there is to know about the sectors and the companies that have to build companies and which companies will succeed and which ones won't. But at the end of the day, this is an industry that is sort of affected by a lot of other factors. That includes market trends, that includes, you know, currency risk, especially across the continent, and a lot of other factors that aren't necessarily controlled by the actual VCs themselves, especially at the end of the day, when you think about the fact that you're investing in companies that are, well, being built by the founders themselves. You're not necessarily the CEO or CTO in most traditional relationships that you have. But I think those are the two main things for me. Mark, I don't know if you wanted to give your perspective on it as well.
Yeah, so I guess perhaps observations and what I've discovered about VC. Well, I think the first one was coming in from a background where I'd previously worked in financial services. VC seems like the kind of annoying kid in the context of asset management and wider financial service provision. Unlike all the other industries in, you know, investments, whether buy side or sell side, VC is the loudest one, speaks the loudest and gets a lot of media attention. But at the same time, it's also the most opinionated one. And I think for me, it was a bit of like a cultural shift going around from working in many companies where you are actually actively encouraged not to share your opinion, not to have a political opinion, not to have any kind of opinion about any sector at all, because it might affect your clientele, to going into the VC industry where that degree of individualism is largely encouraged. You know, it's something that you see a lot of VCs expressing their opinions and giving advice on very publicly. I think that for me was quite shocking. I think the second aspect was just also recognizing that it's definitely a scale up of time rather than a scale down. I think especially in capitalized markets like in the US or in the UK, usually the assumption is that you leave an industry to go into venture capital. You have to learn start in the industry from the beginning. And you do so with the expectation of earning more than you were in a traditional industry and arguably working less. But I think especially in the context of very early stage VC and early stage VC in an emerging market, this is very much flipped on its head. You're earning substantially less and often the amount of work is almost indefinite, because you have to match to an extent the amount of work entrepreneurs are putting in to be a competitive and a good investor for them. And I think that's something that many people maybe don't know and don't expect coming into the industry.
There is this saying that says belief comes before ability. And then there are people that believe also in faking it before you make it. And in a way, I'm not drawing direct parallels, but in a way you sort of described this as how certain investors behave. Now, what is your perspective on that, on faking it till you make it, or, you know, projecting a certain knowledge or projecting something before you're actually it? What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, I think that it oftentimes is associated with a negative connotation when I think the reality for most young people, regardless of whether you're going to VC or going to another career, is that you're learning on the job, right? And I think a lot of founders and investors alike across Africa are doing this for the very first time. And so whether that's a pride thing or you want to be able to also convince yourself in a certain level of confidence that you can execute on something, that is, it's quite a common thing that we do see across the ecosystem. I'll play devil's advocate though, and say that it is a case where as long as the sort of faking it till you make it mindset doesn't negatively impact others and you are rolling up your sleeves and willing to learn the ropes and really trying to absorb the information and are open to advice and constructive criticism, then it is something that I think could be molded and eventually become a not faking it until you make it, but actually making it, right? But that's my perspective. Mark, I don't know if you have a counterpoint to that or if you agree.
Yeah, it's fights. I'm joking.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, like, just one very, very brief point on this is that the whole phrase, like, fake it till you make it, often is used to criticize people who do that, right? But if you actually flip it on its head, I've actually heard a different quote that says the same meaning, but gives you a much more positive, you know, impression. And that is that appearances contribute to reality. I think it's dated back to like the 1960s, where JFK, the US president, managed to weave his way out of a very complicated situation that almost led to a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And essentially, appearances from strength contribute to reality, which can later lead to strength, right? That has a positive implication. And yet often we use the phrase, fake it till you make it. And then we start to assume, oh, well, you're faking it. And then maybe it's like you making it is not as real. So I think it's all about framing it.
I'm of the belief that you be it till you make it, right? You consistently work on yourself, you consistently show up, you consistently output something of value, and then you become it. So yeah, it does contribute in the end to your success. Both of you are really smart people. Both of you are highly opinionated in your own ways. How did you become co-founders? Because one of the most interesting relationship or dynamics is the co-founder dynamics. And we see that it can either make or break any enterprise. How did you both become co-founders?
We can give the condensed version, which is we kind of didn't have a choice in the sense we met in university and we were both working in the same sort of student-run consulting firm at the time, which later spun out to become a independent tech innovation consultancy. So we already met in the context of already working somewhat together. And I think one of the beautiful things about co-founder relationships, if you do come across someone else who works really, really well with you in that sort of same wavelength, is that the pace in which you can work and the efficiency in which you can execute on is incredible. So I think from day one, whether that was back when we used to be in consulting together to later when we were in growth together and now working somewhat in VC and not really in VC, I guess now directly, is Mark and I both have a similar shared passion and vision in things. We oftentimes can align on an objective, execute on it, and we would just be on the same page without necessarily having to have a really complicated kind of communication process. I won't lie and say that it's been like a perfect smooth rainbows at the end of the sunset kind of road. I think we've definitely had hiccups and ups and downs, but at the end of the day, I think the important thing, just like how it's like for any sort of relationship, whether that's with family or friends or with a romantic partner, is that you need to be able to fill in the shoes when different things happen and things become difficult. What I mean by that is I think oftentimes people think that co-founder relationships should always be 100-100 or 50-50. But the reality is that as people, you're not always going to be at your tip-top shape, your most enthusiastic self, the most optimistic self all the time. So what becomes really important for the two of us when we've been working in GBC in other contexts is, let's say Mark is in the throes of founder depression, where you dig yourself into a pit and you feel like nothing's going to work out. Everything is going negatively, that he's putting in the 30%, And out of the 100%, this is where I really need to step up and put in that sort of 70 to ensure that we really make things happen. And this also means that when I'm at that 30%, he also steps up on that side. So I think on this side, it was one, a case in which we just really clicked well in terms of conviction, the working style that we have and other things. But we also really value and respect the relationship that we have with one another in regards to how we respect our opinions as co-founders, how we respect the direction that we're going to go. And I think it's a rare thing to be able to find. But Mark, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that as well.
I'm going to ask Mark something related to that anyways. I was going to ask, again, every relationship, be it co-founder, be it real life, be it marriage, whatever the case may be, are usually formed on its own sets of principles, whether it's been spoken out or agreed silently, right? Mark, for you, especially as a co-founder as a co-founder, what are your own principles when it comes to partnering up with other people and which is non-negotiable?
Principles when it comes to partnering with other firms or principles when it comes
people
to
generally.
Co-founder dynamic?
Yeah.
I mean, I think for me, obviously there's things that I say for when I advise founders about finding a good co-founder for yourself. But personally on my end, what really is the most important thing is aligning on a couple of long-term things that I think are quite, not maybe malleable to change. So ideally, you want to have a co-founder who's on the same page around the long-term vision. You want to have a co-founder who's on the same page about the ambition that they have going into the business. And you want to have a co-founder who, at the end of the day, matches to some extent your work style. It wouldn't really work, for example, for us if one of us was very lazy or used to perhaps doing the minimal amount of work and the other one was super intense, it would probably lead to a lot of conflict. But even though we come from a bit of a different background and we think about problems in a different way, approaching perhaps the same growth objective from 3 or 4 different perspectives between the two of us, I think what really works is at the end, there is this kind of North Star alignment where around the fundamentals, which is like this big picture vision we're building towards, some broad ambitions, the fact that we both are very happy to pull up our sleeves and, you know, work overnight when necessary. I think that means that whenever we have any kind of a conflict on the co-founder level, I know that it's only, you know, problem specific around one challenge. So that doesn't mean that there's a crack in the kind of core foundation or why we're working on this together. And that's actually very satisfying. It's been something that's I haven't had previously in almost any other working engagement I had. So this is like one of the reasons why perhaps I think the co-founding relationship has worked out so well so far.
Interesting approach. Cindy, you sort of at the beginning gave a description of your journey and how you ended up in Dream VC and working on or creating Dream VC. And we all know that life is filled of inflection points where you're forced to reinvent yourself at different times based on what you want, based on situations you find yourself, based on interest, passion, yada, yada. Has there been what is your major inflection point? This question might be a bit personal, but yeah, has there been a major inflection point in your life where you said, hey, I'm going to actually go do this because X, Y, Z, X, Y, Z?
Oh, absolutely. I think on my end, it would have been very early actually in my career or life, if you can call it that. So I would say mine was when I was 18. So some context into this was, I went to a very cutthroat, very academic high school. And by the time I finished high school, I was quite burnt out. And this was a school in which most people had a very almost conveyor belt perspective on how your professional career should go. So the idea was you'd work your butt off, get into an Ivy League, go get a postgrad degree, work in one of the top sectors that, you know, pays you really well, and then hopefully make your very academic parents happy. And I think I had a real moment when I graduated where I realized that I emotionally was not very ready to dive straight into university yet. So I actually had a very untraditional move in the sense that I actually took 2 years between high school and university. So I entered university after almost getting a 2-year perspective on something very different. So in those 2 years, my first year, I decided to move to China. I grew up in a small college town. I went to a big metropolitan city with 20 million plus people. I lived there and worked at a sort of English teaching firm, and I was part of a college that was teaching essentially Chinese diaspora Chinese within the actual city. That was really interesting because I was paying for bills and renting for a place where I couldn't really read all of the language because it was entirely in written Chinese. I only knew how to speak Chinese fluently. And then the next year after that, I went back home and I basically juggled a couple of different just part-time jobs. So I worked in Dojiter sales, where I was basically selling these very fancy knives to rich people. And then I was working in construction for a period of time. I then also worked in a fast food place, et cetera. And I think those 2 years really taught me a couple of different lessons. And that was why it was an inflection point. The first lesson it taught me was that there is no timing that is ideal or perfect for you being at a certain point at a certain time. So you don't need to go to college immediately when you're 18, and then you have to do this by a certain time, and you have to be successful in a career by a certain age. And a second thing was just a healthy dose of respect for anyone that was working in a service in like service industry or service-oriented industry. And it was actually because of these 2 years that I decided to not go to university in the US. I ended up going to university in the UK because I wanted to just explore something really different and carve out my own niche. And if I hadn't made that move, I wouldn't have never met Mark in Edinburgh, and Dream VC might not have become what it is today. So I would say that that's a pretty big inflection point on my end.
Talking about Dream VC, the goal of every VC or every venture capitalist, for those listening, I don't know VC, is that you're trying to increase the odds of success, right? Now, zooming in on the work that Dream VC does, Mark, how are you increasing the odds for people that are interested in VC?
I mean, I think for us, we're pretty intentional in increasing the likelihood of success by those individuals after they go through the Dream VC community. I think generally speaking, when we actually try and kind of group together all the common sense or, you know, collective wisdom that maybe the VC space have built up over time, usually there isn't one specific formula for success. It's somewhat tailored to each individual, but you can try and summarize it across a couple of core points. At least we believe you can. We think it really comes back to your essential understanding of the industry. So the knowledge aspect, it comes down to the skill sets you put into the industry. So how you leverage your strengths, how you optimize the fact that you have a particular background in the context of supporting startups or working in a VC. And finally, it comes down to how you leverage your network, essentially the social capital that you hear VCs talk about all the time. How can you leverage people, businesses, organizations all around you within the innovation ecosystem? So for us, we really hone in on these three points. How can we build those three out? On the knowledge side, we have one of the most comprehensive curriculums we've ever seen. So we built something that we would have wanted to have, so that we would have had to spend years essentially learning those concepts from scratch, covering really the 0 to 100 of knowledge around venture capital investments, supporting startups as different types of investors at an early stage, both covering the equity side and also, you know, alternatives such as venture debt and revenue sharing. At the same time, we then have the community itself, which means people are constantly sharing about their experiences and they're learning from each other as well as from the instructor. This teaches people how the diversity of background that you might have as an individual, which maybe in a standard industry is a disadvantage, is actually very much an advantage when it comes to startups. Whether you're a VC or a startup, having multiple different things you're really good at means that you can leverage as multiple different things to save costs, to be more efficient, to think innovatively, to find creative ideas for difficult solutions. And I think finally, the social capital aspect is really kind of the main thing that fellows come to us for. We essentially try to break the stigma that VC has to look a particular way and come from a particular socioeconomic class. Anybody can come to a Dream VC program as long as they get through our applications. And if they do, then they come out of the program knowing the existing incumbent investors, knowing, you know, 50, 100, hundreds of people and the alumni who are active in the VC space and being already part of the industry without having to go through this, you know, multi-year process of proving that you are worthy of being in the industry, which is still very much the status quo in many parts of the world, and which is why it's so difficult to disrupt this tendency where we see a lot of VCs from a similar background, a similar schooling. So we're trying to really flip that on it.
That's actually amazing. The work that you both are doing, it's great. Again, zeroing in on Dream VC and the venture capital landscape anyways, Cindy, just like that philosophical question, which comes first, the chicken or the egg, what do we need more of? More investors or do we need more founders?
Ooh, very interesting question. I feel like if you were to ask me, I would say that we would need more founders in the sense that I feel that some of the best investors I've ever met are founders turned investors. And yes, there will always be the issue of capital and that whole elephant in the room situation. But I think that the most innovative and gritty founders that I know have been very creative about the ways that they have been able to bootstrap and even to an extent grow. And we oftentimes even use an example within Dream VC of several very prominent companies that entirely bootstrap themselves into success. And so I think that's my perspective on it. I think it's definitely a tricky question because it is, like you said, a chicken and egg scenario. But I think if I were to kind of hedge my bets into it, I would say probably more founders.
Okay. More founders. Power to all the founders that are listening. Mark, you kind of talked about, and it's interesting because I am asking Mark all about Dream VC. Cindy, I'll give it to you. Mark, what does success look like for you? How are you going to measure success? Maybe this question is for both of you. What metrics would you use to measure the success of Dream VC?
Actually, I love this question because this is one of the ones we get asked the most often by prospective fellows that apply to Dream VC. They actually want to know what success means like to us because it doesn't seem apparent. As we're not a VC firm, we're not pipelining people into a specific post-program outcome. So what is success for us? And for us, the answer is actually something that has kind of multiple different dimensions. Of course, maybe Cindy's perspective on this might be a bit different, but at least from where I'm sitting, I see success as bespoke success on an individual level, where an individual comes to Dream VC with a specific goal. If they leave Dream VC and they are much more informed about how to achieve that goal and whether or not that goal is actually the goal they want to achieve, I would consider that a success. For example, they go into the program wanting to secure a role as a VC analyst or VC associate. Usually they finish the program, and if they feel that that's still their goal, almost certainly, 90% plus of outcomes, they will go and achieve that goal. But if they then finish the program and they actually don't want to be a VC analyst associate, maybe that's not the career shift that's right for them. Maybe they realize being a founder is more interesting or working in some other aspect of the industry. Then that's also success as far as I'm concerned, because we've helped them essentially go through a really major career and life. On a broader level, though, I think just success is improving the knowledge base and the standards in the VC space in Africa today. So I think a lot of things aren't called out. Unethical behavior, both by founders and by investors, a relative lack of digitization, relatively poor due diligence practices, and just a set of expectations that I feel sometimes create a less than amenable workplace culture in many VC firms. Well, we're looking to change that. I think the best way to change that is change the future people making decisions in those VC firms. So you need to make sure that the people who will later become the investment managers, the principals, the partners, the advisory board members, et cetera, for VCs, they hold themselves and their firms to a really high standard and really care about their teams. And if we kind of breed that value and that culture at a very early stage in their careers, and then they go and take that and spread that out, then fantastic, right? We've not just impacted them, we've impacted them and their firms and their founders and the network. So I think that's what success would mean like to me.
Cindy, what of you?
I think Mark covered most of it. I think I'll also sort of add in a success standpoint from my personal end, which is I would love to see much more women in this space, whether that just means that when I go to gatherings, I see much more familiar faces, and also being able to just have other young women see tangible examples and see how, from regardless of any kind of background that you have or skill set that you have, that this is a transition that you can make and is one that you can make with confidence is really important to me as like a personal ethos, I suppose. I think that's the one other thing I'll add, because I think Mark did a pretty comprehensive overview of most of the other ones that we're aligned on.
Yeah, let's talk diversity. You're quite outspoken about diversity in the VC space and generally. What would you say is the reason why we just are not hitting diversity targets. There's so much noise, you know, around diversity. We've gone from, I mean, over the last few years, everywhere there is, you know, Black BLM, you know, everybody's doing stuff or posturing. But in the end, that we're seeing that there's just not enough diversity. The numbers are even reducing instead of increasing. So what do you think fundamentally is the problem, and how do you think we can solve it?
Oh, this is such a nuanced question. And I think there have been several interesting studies that have been done about this in different frameworks. But for me, I think there are sort of three key elements or reasons behind this. And I'm assuming that we're speaking on both sort of the founder and the investor side. I think the first side is perhaps a social and cultural one that is, we're talking uniquely in the African context, this is a global context as well. But I think there is definitely a bias when it comes to women that are fundraising and the kinds of questions that they get asked and perhaps the expectations or biases that would be involved. For example, if you are a pregnant female founder that is trying to raise capital, I'm sure you would ask specific questions that you wouldn't if you were perhaps a male founder. And the second thing that I'll bring up is just on the sort of early stage talent pipeline, whether that's into, you know, founders or investor side. On the founders side, you still have a critical need in which we don't have a lot of female tech talent. So in the sense that it's like hard CTOs or even women that are transitioning from certain spaces, I think by far the biggest area we see the most women transitioning into, transitioning from is financial services, legal services, that side. And if there is a more tangible or safe space that we can build for them and perhaps a better support mechanism we can put in place for that, I think that would definitely help on that end. Finally, I think on the investor side, a lot of it is just still the traditional gatekeeping and barriers that happen. And also the fact that a lot of young women, if you don't see people that you feel like look like you, or perhaps you can relate to, or perhaps have a certain similar background than you, or you don't have the sort of resources or the network to break into certain circles, then it seems like a career path that you would not even consider, right? It's still important to remember that at the end of the day, for a lot of venture capital firms and on the investment side, it's still very niche. I think it's a much easier problem to tackle on the founder side because there's a lot more specific mechanisms you can put in place. And I could go on and on and on and on, but for the sake of time, I think these are some of the main things we've identified. And there's actually several really, really good resources you can look online. So for those listening, you can check out 2X Global. They have really, really interesting resources specifically on gender lens investing and supporting female founders. So that could be a great thing for you to read up on.
Thank you, Cindy, for that comprehensive response. You've all been listening to Mark and Cindy of Dream VC. And as you can hear, they are really amazing people that we could keep on chatting and chatting all day. But we have to round up. Mark and Cindy, one final question for you both. Do you have an unconventional thought that you'd like to share? So something you believe in, but you don't think most people will agree on.
Mark, I'll throw you this one first.
That unconventional thought that most people wouldn't agree on. Well, I think for me, at least, a lot of people question other people's motivations when we're talking about why someone is doing something. Why is Elon Musk doing something? Why is Bill Gates doing something? Why is somebody else working on a particular solution? Why is a founder building something? And I think for me, quite often, the initial reason why someone does a particular decision isn't as important to me as the result of that decision, and as how perhaps the execution affects the ultimate motivations for a founder. So for me, I think the questioning of people's initial motivations is sometimes a bit aggressive. And I would be very happy to work with someone who maybe is building because of some vice. You know, I have no issue if someone's building because of a desire for consumption or a desire for power or a desire for authority. To a large extent, a lot of the decisions I make are driven by a personal curiosity to always want to discover something else or learn something new. So in that sense, I feel like maybe this is a personal opinion and many people would disagree on, but I don't feel like the initial reason for building something or launching something is, you know, as important as people attribute it to in the social media context.
Interesting. Cindy?
I think for mine, it's around not necessarily blindly worshiping or idolizing certain individuals and putting them on a pedestal. I think everyone's heard of the saying that you shouldn't meet your idols because you'll probably be disappointed. But I think oftentimes it's not so much that that person is a disappointing individual. It's that you had unrealistic expectations or certain, I guess, ideas of how this person would be like. And the reason why I say this is that I think oftentimes you have to remember that people are imperfect, and the way that you present yourself or others present themselves is always going to be in a certain way, right? The way that they want to be seen. And I think for me, it's really important, especially working in a very people-driven industry, to always remember that at the end of the day, people make mistakes, people are imperfect, there are a lot of different nuances to everything. And I think oftentimes when we blindly follow people or blindly worship them and put them on a pedestal, it puts a lot of power into a toxic side of a sort of particular dynamic. And we've seen this historically as well, right? And so I just think that it's something important to keep in mind, especially with the advent of sort of tech Twitter, VC Twitter, to take everything with a grain of salt and to not necessarily just see this person as like a glowing halo up in the sky. Because when you actually meet them, they're just a normal person as well.
Great, great talking to you both. And have a lovely day. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, sir.
Cheers. Thank you.
That's all on today's episode of The Grinders Table. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Monsieur Oum. That's at Monsieur for Mr. in French, Oum. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.